word in the Old Testament in the book of Job, chapters 18 and 19. The book of Job, chapters 18 and 19, Bildad's second speech. The second of the three friends speaks for the second time, and Job replies in this wonderful 19th chapter. Then Bildad the Shuhite replied to Job, "When will you end these speeches? Be sensible, and then we can talk. Why are we regarded as cattle and considered stupid in your sight? You who tear yourself to pieces in your anger, is the earth to be abandoned for your sake, or must the rocks be moved from their place?" And then a diatribe about the punishments of the wicked. Assuming, of course, that Job is suffering for his sins, whereas God at the beginning has said he's not suffering for his sins, but suffering on account of his righteousness and his blamelessness. See how wrong this man is about Job. The lamp of the wicked is snuffed out. The flame of his fire stops burning. The light in his tent becomes dark. The lamp beside him goes out. The vigor of his step is weakened. His own schemes throw him down. His feet thrust him into a net, and he wanders into its mesh. A trap seizes him by the heel. A snare holds him fast. A noose is hidden for him on the ground. A trap lies in his path. Terrors startle him on every side and dog his every step. Calamity is hungry for him. Disaster is ready for him when he falls. It eats away parts of his skin. And then this line, "Death's firstborn." What does that mean? Death's firstborn. Is that demonic? Devours his limbs. He is torn from the security of his tent and marched off to the king of terrors. Fire resides in his tent, burning sulfur is scattered over his dwelling. His roots dry up below, and his branches wither above. The memory of him perishes from the earth. He has no name in the land. He is driven from light into darkness and is banished from the world. He has no offspring. This must have been very sore for Job, who had lost all his family. He has no offspring or descendants among his people, no survivor where once he lived. Men of the West are appalled at his fate. Men of the East are seized with horror. Surely such is the dwelling of an evil man. Such is the place of one who knows not God. Then Job replied, "How long will you torment me and crush me with words? 10 times now you have reproached me. Shamelessly you attack me. If it is true that I have gone astray, my error remains my concern alone, my business. If indeed you would exalt yourselves above me and use my humiliation against me, then know this, that God has wronged me and drawn his net around me." That's what he thinks, because he doesn't know Satan, who is really afflicting him. "Though I cry, I have been wronged, I get no response. Though I call for help, there is no justice. He has blocked my way so that I cannot pass. He has shrouded my paths in darkness. He has stripped me of my honor and removed the crown from my head. He tears me down on every side till I am gone. He uproots my hope like a tree. His anger burns against me. He counts me among his enemies. His troops advance in force. They build a siege ramp against me and encamp around my tent. Not only so, but he has alienated my brothers from me. My acquaintances are completely estranged from me. My kinsmen have gone away. My friends have forgotten me. My guests and my maidservants count me a stranger. They look upon me as an alien. I summon my servant, but he does not answer. Though I beg him with my own mouth, my breath is offensive to my wife. I am loathsome to my own brothers. Even the little boys scorn me. When I appear, they ridicule me. All my intimate friends detest me. Those I love have turned against me. I am nothing but skin and bones. I have escaped by only the skin of my teeth. Have pity on me, my friends, have pity, for the hand of God has struck me. Why do you pursue me as God does? Will you never get enough of my flesh? And then this is the great and most famous passage in the whole book. Oh, that my words were recorded, that they were written. And he suggests three ways of writing: that they were written on a scroll, that they were inscribed with an iron tool, an iron stylus, on lead, or engraved in rock forever. I know that my Redeemer lives, and that in the end he will stand upon the earth. And after my skin has been destroyed, yet in my flesh I will see God. I myself will see him with my own eyes, I and not another. How my heart yearns within me, he says. If you say, how we will hound him, since the root of the trouble lies in him, you should fear the sword yourselves, for wrath will bring punishment by the sword. And then you will know that there is judgment, and judgment for them. Amen. May God bless to us his holy word. The book of Job, chapters 18 and 19. Poor Bildad. He has nothing new to say. It is as if he had scarcely heard at all what Job had been saying. And as for Job's insights, they pass over this man's head silently like birds in the night. He has it fixed in his mind that this trouble of Job's can arise from nothing else than a wicked life. Someone must have told him that this was a thing to say. Possibly it was Eliphaz, the first speaker, who did so. And so Bildad is sticking to it. And of course it's a common failing with unthinking people, of whom, alas, there are so many these days, who refuse to think. The hardest thing in the world is to get them to think. They have no original mind, for which, of course, they are more to be pitied than scorned. But if only they were honest enough to admit it, and would acknowledge that they had to get practically all their ideas from other folk, there would be nothing wrong in that. After all, we all had to get our first ideas from others, since we hardly came with any. And yet, Wordsworth, the poet, you know, thought otherwise. In his Ode to Immortality, he says, "The child is the father of the man." And that the infant arrives on earth, you remember, trailing clouds of glory. Ah, but that's a fanciful conceit based on the uncanny insights of little children, simply because these precious youngsters work overtime in their tiny minds, as we very well know, parents in particular and teachers know. They work overtime in their tiny minds, exploring what they have learned, which is to say that the potential of a new mind in a little one can be fantastic. But potential is not the same as actual. Much work of absorption has to be done after that to fill the matrix of a tiny mind with material for infinite imaginings, and sometimes, as we know, penetrating insights. Poor Bildad. It is fixed in his mind that Job is evil, and that this putrid mess that these three see before them is the due desert of an evil life. We suppose it would not occur to the man, Bildad, that he might be wrong. If it did occur to him, would he not be smitten with a sense of guilt at heaving such a load of inappropriate rubbish on a hapless, innocent head? No. He's sure he's right. Job is evil and is suffering for his sins, and so he barges on without the slightest hint that he might be wrong, and that the fixed notion he has got into his head might be flying in the face of all that the Almighty has already said about Job in the first two chapters. But we'd better get the chapter over with, chapter 18, so as to come to the chapter 19 with its wonderful climax of resurrection, and come to it with relish, in which it is plainly stated that the Christ lives, the Redeemer lives. And you know, when Handel's librettist sought for words to extol Christ's resurrection for his great work, Messiah, the librettist found the words on Christ's resurrection not in the New Testament after the event, but in this chapter in the Old Testament. So very, very long before the actual resurrection, before the incarnation. Wonderful. But Bildad is tired of Job's speeches, because to his poor mind they are not sensible, he says. Who dare accuse the three friends of being cattle and stupid? But surely that's a complete misunderstanding of anything Job has said. He never said anything like that about them. Of course, Job has been angry. Who would blame him for that? Bildad, if your world had collapsed around you, would you not have felt that the whole universe had undergone an appalling transformation, and something and nothing was the same after that? For Job, the earth that he knew had been taken from beneath his feet, and every stable rock he had ever held on to was dissolved before his eyes. Poor Job was in a kind of a molten hell. So, Bildad, your metaphors are not in Job's bitter experience so impossibly outrageous as you may have thought they were. Nothing less than a new, horrible world has appeared to Job and has enveloped the poor man in its fiery conflagration. And Bildad, all that you can do in this man's distressing situation is to charge him with the greatest possible wickedness. How in the world could you? And in such a snide way, too. Oh, no, of course, you would say you're not speaking in the second person, but in the third. You are speaking of the wicked. But, of course, without any personal imputation. Huh? You smooth rascal. Then why unload this heap of innuendos on poor Job? Does this poor man need your recital of the woes of the wicked? For you see, in this chapter there follows a series of metaphors with the most wretched implications for the truly wicked. The lamp of the wicked is snuffed out. The flame of his life stops burning. The light in his tent goes out, and the lamp by his bedside. Then he becomes unsteady on his feet, so that he's not able to go where he wants, but lands in a net and is trapped by the heels with a noose round his neck. And such an experience of enslavement and fear takes hold of him that he is terrified to take another step, lest he lands in greater trouble. "Oh, calamity," he cries, "you are hungry to devour me. You begin by nibbling at my skin." Well now, what an expression this man Bildad uses to describe the wicked's torments. You would almost think that he had been reared within yards of the gate of hell. He says, "Death's firstborn devours the limbs of the transgressor." What does he mean by that? Does he mean Satan's offspring, his first arch demon? We don't know. Anyway, the poor victim is torn from his moorings and is marched off to face the king of terrors himself. Then he's back to his tent again, poor Job, from which emanates the fumes of burning sulphur. And this, of course, may be a veiled reference to what happened to Job's flocks and shepherds. They were consumed in fire, Job 1:16, so that his roots dry up, and of course his branches wither, and that's him gone forever, or so Bildad says, for his memory perishes from the earth. Whereas Proverbs 10 and 7 says that while the memory of the righteous will be blessed, the memory of the wicked will rot. And Isaiah says the memory of the wicked will be wiped out. And Bildad goes on, you see, in this frame. Such a creature has no longer any name in the land, he says, and is driven from light into darkness and is banished from the world. He does not even have offspring or descendants among the people. And that, as I was saying during the reading, must have hit poor Job particularly hard when he thought of his family, every one of them wiped out. He had no survivors except an unsympathetic wife. And so Bildad at last ends with this exaggerated claim that the denouement of the wicked is so lurid that the whole world hears of it, east and west. Such, he concludes, is the fate of the wicked. And that is what Job is bound to come to. That's the clear implication. Well, you need your breath, don't you, after that tour of hell, tour de force, indeed, with the emphasis on the fourth. But take a look at Job in chapter 19. How he has weathered this onslaught. As you can imagine, the poor man is utterly lacerated and almost beyond words to describe the horror of this appalling and vicious attack upon him. Yet he patiently and moderately exclaims his distress. How long will you torment me and crush me with words? He says. And we echo poor Job, don't we, and say, oh, words, words, words. What wounding things words are or can be from certain sources. Far more wounding than blows or bricks. But you see here, it seems to me, it's the repetition, the sheer relentless eloquence of the assault that bowls the man over. 10 times now, says Job, you have reproached me without the slightest sign of any shame or consideration for the fact that you are piling agony upon a man who is already suffering excruciatingly. Have pity, man. And in all humility for a moment, Job is willing to assume that he may be guilty of some of the things leveled against him. That in fact, he may have gone astray, which of course isn't true. But he says, what of it? If I have gone astray, that's my business, not yours. I didn't ask you to come here with the other two to torment me. If you really want to know the truth, so that you can assume an attitude of superiority over me, the truth is, and here Job is very, very daring. You may be shocked at this, but don't be. Because he doesn't know that the devil is trying him. If you really want to know the truth, so that you can assume an attitude of superiority over me, the truth is, says Job, that God has wronged me and not I him. That's very daring. Now you see, if that were true, that would be terrible, that would be blasphemous. But he doesn't know a devil. He really believes, against his will, he really believes that God has changed into the devil. And if you don't understand that, you won't understand the book at all. What else could he think? There aren't two gods. And he thinks it's God that's doing it. God is permitting it. God is permitting it. He's not doing it. Satan is doing it. But the poor man doesn't know of Satan. God has wronged me, not I him. And as you can imagine, that added fuel to the fire of these pursuing fellows. But that's the truth as Job sees it. And so, whatever it costs him to say it, he goes on to say it. What courage! What courage! Oh, you must admire the courage of a man who dares to say this, don't you? Indeed, from this word alone, I think we have sure evidence of the absolute integrity of the man, that he swears even to his hurt, either at the hands of God or of man. I keep saying this to God, he says, but I get no response. Where is the justice in this, he says. God has blocked my way so that I cannot get out, and I am literally shrouded in darkness without even the slightest glimmer of light. As I look back to what I was, he says, formerly, I am stripped of any honor I ever had. And any crowning glory I had as a man of consequence. It's all swept from me. the ruthlessness of God's dismantling of me is amazing. He says, I am torn down on every side, and any hope I had is torn up like the roots of a tree. Not only so, but God's anger burns against me, and I am counted his enemy. Indeed, his troops of destroying angels advance and build a siege ramp against me and encamp around my tent. And that's not all, he goes on. And whatever he means by brethren here, he says they have been alienated from him and his acquaintances are completely estranged from him. Now, as we read this, this is almost unbelievable that his friends and acquaintances and loved ones, even his wife, had turned against him. Almost unbelievable. But of course one has heard of others having an experience in which, in the midst of their plight, even their nearest and dearest have kept away from them so incomprehensibly that it almost drove the sufferer crazy. It's very hard to be deserted when you need a friend the most. And yet, there is an explanation. It is God who is doing it, to isolate the sufferer from all those who would help. Have you ever longed to help someone in distress and God wouldn't let you? Have you ever been in that position? And despite all you plan, all your desire to help, God hinders you from touching them. And you think, how awful, what a brute, how cruel I am. But it may be the Lord who is saying to you, leave them to me. Leave them to me. So he isolates the sufferer, that he has no help but God. That sometimes happens. We could misuse that, of course, but it's true. But you might say that on this occasion, such an explanation is singularly inappropriate. For God himself is not taking any notice of the anguished man, Job. Well, admittedly, he is certainly not answering him. But do you think that is because God doesn't care or is too busy? God's silences are often his most eloquent utterances. Well, silence in music is very often much more telling than all the notes. You need the notes first, of course, and then the silence. And it speaks, challenges. Yes. God's silences are often his most eloquent utterances, although that eloquence awaits subsequent words to interpret the silence. So the next verses tell their own dreary tale of how utterly isolated this dear man Job is. And the words, they would really almost draw tears of blood from a stone. So heart-rending are his words. Look at them. 19:14. My kinsmen have gone away. My friends have forgotten me. My guests and my maidservants count me a stranger. They look upon me as an alien. I summon my servant, but he does not answer, though I beg him with my own mouth. My breath is offensive to my wife. I am loathsome to my own brothers. Even the little boys scorn me. When I appear, they ridicule me. All my intimate friends detest me. Those I love have turned against me. I am nothing but skin and bones, and I have escaped by only the skin of my teeth. And he ends this recital of desertions from him with one of the most piteous cries ever made by man. It is almost tantamount to that famous cry, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Ah, but Job's cry is not a cry here to God, but to his heartless friends, isn't it? Have pity on me, my friends, have pity, for the hand of God has struck me. Why do you pursue me as God does? Will you never get enough of my flesh? Then comes the most famous passage in the book, when Job's extreme distress forces him to seek what turns out to be the intensest insight of his ordeal. But note Job's insights through the book. His insights are all in the form of fond imaginations, imaginings. But then his imaginings are so true to what proved in the course of time to become orthodox Christian doctrine that we cannot doubt that the man's longings were God-inspired, and that they describe with astonishing accuracy events as they ultimately took place with regard to our Lord, and teachings in relation to them, which, as I say, have become the soul of orthodox doctrine. But for all his agony, Job must have known, you see, that the Spirit of God was with him as he uttered these words, don't you think? Because he knew the words were immortal, and his earnest desire is that they should not vanish into thin air. These words that God has put into his mind and his imagination, they mustn't be lost. They must be recorded permanently, either in a parchment scroll, or even better, inscribed on lead with an iron stylus, or better, even still, better, engraven on rock. And of course, we instantly know why he is concerned that they should not be lost, these precious words, for they are words. They are words which have rung down through the centuries, and for the last century and a half have been enshrined for us Western people in the assured cadences of Handel's Messiah. I know that my Redeemer lives. Yes. But what does he mean by Redeemer? Are we to transport our modern New Testament meaning into the word here simply? Not quite. The word here means vindicator, an advocate who will stand up for Job against the rash of accusations leveled against him. Indeed, the New Testament word paraclete, which has been translated comforter, is as good a meaning as we may find. For Job is seeking one to stand by him, and not merely comfort or encourage him, although that is the meaning, but to comfort and encourage him by speaking in his defense. And you see, the great thing about this conviction which he has about an advocate is that up in heaven, where the ultimate and eternal truth is known, there is one who knows that he is not suffering for his sins, but for righteousness. He is suffering for righteousness' sake in order to advance God's purposes for him, as well as to teach us profound lessons. Indeed, to teach us profound lessons amongst the most profound in the Bible, here in Job chapter 19. And of course, the one who stands in for us, for Job and for us, our substitute, as John tells us in his first letter, chapter 2, verses 1 and 2. The one who stands in for us is the divine Parakletos with the Father, Jesus Christ, the righteous, the advocate who stands by us to speak defensively for us in merciful terms. But we know, of course, that Jesus Christ does this not merely by words, but by the whole of his substitutionary atonement, dying in our place, which through the sacrifice of his precious blood appeases the wrath of God and propitiates the Father, Romans 3:25. And the mercy which 1 John 2 and 2 says the divine advocate proffers on our behalf, the mercy is called the propitiation, in Romans 3:25. And that, in the Old Testament, is the covering of blood which was sprinkled on the mercy seat of the ark. The high priest once in the year entered into the holiest place of all, not without blood, and he took the blood and he sprinkled it on what was virtually the judgment seat, because under this golden cover lay the tablets of the Ten Commandments, God's holy law, 8 of which says, thou shalt not. That's God's judgment seat. But once in the year, symbolizing Christ's once for all sacrifice, the high priest enters into the most holy place and sprinkles the blood of the Lamb upon the seat, and the judgment seat of God for our sins becomes the mercy seat of our pardon. And this is all involved. Ultimately, it is clear in the New Testament, all involved in this wonderful word, Redeemer, Vindicator, Champion. It is thus, therefore, that Jesus Christ is our Redeemer, our Vindicator, our Champion, and it is the elemental seed of all this contained in the Word, which Job declares with such vehemence, I know that my Redeemer lives. But notice, Job doesn't go on to explain what his Redeemer does. We've got to go to other places to find that out. Except that having done it, he wills to stand on the earth again. Job goes right, you see, from the fact of the Redeemer, without describing what he does at all, or what Redeemer means. He goes right from that to his resurrection. He doesn't go on to explain what it means, except I say that having done it, he will stand on the earth again, and we know that that points to his resurrection, to Christ's resurrection body, because it is the fact that there is such a being in heaven, in face of the seeming horrible transformation of the God Job knew and loved into this awful being who comes to him directly in his personal sufferings, as also his trouble comes through the agency of these three friends. In face of what he can only believe, that God has turned into a monster who hates him. You see, in a sense, he's lost in a duality. His mind is split. He knows his God is God and is good and is true to his name, and he won't let go of that. God has given them that by the gift of faith, saving, justifying faith. And yet he has no present personal experience just now in his agonies of that good God. It would seem to him, although he believes that that good God is eternal, as far as his experience is concerned, he could easily believe that he'd gone, that he'd vanished. And in his place, this monster. But you see, in spite of all that he says against this bad, cruel, quote, God, unquote, who has done him so much harm and ill, he still believes in God, his Redeemer, his Vindicator. You can say he has a split mind if you like, but he doesn't lose hold of his God. And that's amazing. That's fabulous, isn't it? So that the thought that his Redeemer lives fills his heart and mind with such an anticipative joy, who for the joy that was set before him, we might quote, that Job wants these words engraven in rock, something durable for all time. And I thought we were singing Top Lady, weren't we? Later on, Job, if he'd been living in a later day, last century, he would have been thrilled by Top Lady's words that we sang this evening. My name from the palms of his hands, eternity will not erase, impressed on his heart. It remains in marks of indelible grace. Wonderful. Of course, the fact that he says his Redeemer lives may immediately be taken to mean that he lives eternally in a resurrection body. But not in Job's day. Whether or not Job foresaw a long period before his Vindicator, Jesus Christ, would appear, to us, Job is speaking in what we would need to call, he is speaking in the prophetic perfect tense. What is to happen? And it would take many more than 1,000 years to happen, whatever date you give to Job and the writing of Job. Job is speaking of it as if it had taken place. I know that my Redeemer will live, future tense, no, eternal present, or perfect, if you like, you grammarians. For you see, it seemed that it was sufficient for Job simply that there was such a one up there, and that in time, however long it took, he would appear. And so the conviction of faith is so strong that he turns the future into the present. Isn't that marvelous? To turn the future into the present. As if he was sitting in heaven himself then. And not, poor chap, in a kind of a hell. That Job should go on to describe him in such explicit resurrection terms is quite overwhelming to me. For Job to move from the fact that there was such a champion to move from that to delineate so clearly the nature of Job's own resurrection body simply fills us with awe that a man so ancient as Job should have been given so early in history such explicit terms about resurrection that he would yet stand on the earth, and that after his skin, and we may imagine that Job's deplorable condition, in his deplorable condition, anything to do with skin, when his was in such a putrid mess, was significant, that after his skin was destroyed, yet in his flesh, he would see God. And he would see him with his very own eyes, none other. And see him to be on his side. And that penetrating gleam of light so moves the dear man Job that he cries out, "How my heart within me fails with longing." He means, of course, longing for such a solution as may be found to his fearful problem. And with that explanation, Job seems to come to himself. He comes down from the heights and becomes aware of his three friends again. And turning to these toward the end of the chapter, he challenges them. "If you say, 'How we will hound him, since the root of his trouble lies in himself,' should you not fear the sword yourselves? If there is wrath against you fellows for all you have said against me, may it not come upon you by the sword? Then you would know that there is a judgment on men such as yourselves, who pile up accusation upon accusation upon a man suffering the most exquisite and excruciating agonies for no sinful reason at all." And the implication there may be, Job says, "I have my gleams of glory and long for some such solution to my problems as I have seen in these inspired insights. But although I do not understand what has befallen me, since I have no guilty feelings about it at all," how could he have guilty feelings when God said he was blameless? And that, we may add, is in itself wonderful. "I think," he says, this is what I imagine is in his mind, "I think it is very daring of you fellows to be so sure of yourselves about another man's trouble, so that you so roundly condemn me out of hand without the slightest knowledge or understanding of what I am going through, or why I'm going through what I'm going through." So that's the crucial chapter of the book of Job, with Job's finest insight, all seen in the midst of his appalling sufferings, with these three, and apparently the common people joining in, with these three breathing down his neck, which is perhaps a parable for us. Are we so constructed, and has the evil element in our fallen nature taken such a hold of us, that regenerate, born again though we may be, it is only in the fiery furnace of affliction that, as Adelaide Ann Proctor said in her hymn we sang, only then we see gleaming on high diviner things. That it's only sorrow and trouble, out of sorrow and trouble, that we see the vision of heaven. I'm reminded of Isa Ross's favorite quotation. Isa Ross was a farm lass from Turriff who served for 30 costly years in southern Morocco for a handful of converts, including the chief man of the town of Mogador. Not Mogadon, but Mogador, across from Gibraltar. I had a look at it in the map before I came out. Because, you see, I have a rugged home in the manse, which this chief citizen of Mogador, Sire Greggy was his name, a rug that he wove for me and scented by Isa with Union Jacks in the corners of it. Isa, you see, out of the weight of the woe she suffered in that land for so many years, seeing, and I've been looking at some of the pictures she sent of her girls, seeing her beloved girls poisoned by their own families because they owned Christ. Yes. Isa used to say, out of the presses of pain comes forth the soul's best wine. Isn't that exquisite? Out of the presses of pain comes forth the soul's best wine. Now that may make us feel sad, but that would not be a good note, or even a right note, on which to end such a wonderful chapter as this. Because of the resurrection, we must refuse to be sad. Ever. All that we are likely to suffer for Christ, or see others whom we love and care for suffer, which can be worse, must be seen in the light of the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And of course, the best word to encourage us in that is in the letter to the Hebrews 12:2. Which is spoken of our blessed Lord. I quoted it earlier. Who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is now sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. And the writer goes on. Therefore, he says, in view of that, the joy that was set before him had enabled him to endure so much. Consider him, he says. Consider him. And if you do, that will be enough to enable you and me, like so many sufferers before us, to preserve in our trials the greatest good humor, even in the midst of excessive trials. One of the most suffering saints in Scotland is Tom Swanston, who, because of his arthritis, suffers in every joint of his body from his head to his toes, constantly, night and day. And you won't find such a cheerful chappie in the whole of Scotland or England either. Putting aside even your references to his trouble, as if that was nothing. How is that? It's the grace of God. Nothing else. Nothing less. For you see, we may emit a cry of protest now and then, like Job did. Nothing wrong with that. Some people won't allow others to cry or to moan. We all need to moan sometimes, and to cry. And it's sick people who can't cry. You knew that, didn't you? Never say to people when they're in distress, stop crying. Silly. Ignorant. I say we may emit a protest, a cry of protest now and then, like Job did, when it hurts most deeply. But that will simply be a momentary departure, even if that, from our confident outlook that God purposes good for us by every pain we suffer. And that is cause for rejoicing, isn't it? The last thing in the world we should be with such a resurrection as Christ's behind him and behind us, and such a resurrection as ours ahead of us, the last thing in the world we should be is pessimistic and mourning and negative and depressed. Christians of all people must be incurable optimists. For to borrow Browning's words again, somebody said recently we shouldn't quote Browning in the pulpit. Tell them to mind their own business. The best is yet to be. Amen.